This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElrath.
Yeah, we've been out and about all over Scotland as usual. And I've got a rather interesting story down in the Ardeer Peninsula, which is a place I've never been before, but trust me, it's a fascinating story.
It used to be a huge explosives.
It's the biggest in the world.
Yeah, network. You know, basically, that's where they actually made it. It was ICI, etc.
But it's quite an intriguing story.
Indeed. I'm going to start much, much closer to home. I mean, literally about 6 or 7 miles away from where I stay is a town called Inverurie. It's a former market town.
It's almost a city now. I mean, it's growing exponentially.
Huge, absolutely huge.
Every time I drive past it, there's another housing estate.
Exactly. And we are talking about growing into, you know, by individual housing estates. It's got new housing estates, it's got retail parks, a new school that is halfway to the next town, admittedly, but there is still, in amongst all this, some green space. Now, created on a floodplain, Uri Riverside Park has become a really popular destination for residents looking to spend some time outdoors. I went for a wander around it with one of the park's trustees, Martin Auld.
This path was put in wide enough so people could use it through the middle of the park to join up with the bridge, which was originally called, interestingly, the Bridge to Nowhere, but is now
which
the bridge.
Which it was at the time.
At the time, but is now wonderfully the Bridge to Somewhere. So you can walk from Osprey Heights, Osprey Village, all the way through to the town, across this wonderful site. And we didn't want any light pollution, and this needs to stay down within the floodplain as well. So we put diode lights into the surface of the path, and they're charged with little solar cells. Uh-huh. On one occasion, after it all been put in, we came out and the surface of every single one was covered with a little mound of earth.
Somebody didn't like the lights.
I think probably a small person had come along and thought it was quite an interesting thing to do. So we had to go along and sweep them all off.
This is an interesting partnership, and it's because essentially the land is owned by Aberdeenshire Council.
Yes.
But the trust is now running. Who are the trust? Who are you?
Well, the SCIO are a small group of people who came together and set it up on behalf of the town and the people of Inverurie. Mm-hmm. So everybody in Inverurie can be a member if they want to be.
SCIO stands for what?
Scottish Charitable Incorporated Organisation.
You must have a name, surely. You can't just call yourself SCIO.
Well, we're called the Uri Riverside Park SCIO. It's a wonderful sort of mishmash of names. But Uri Riverside Park, I think people would recognise.
Susan Adams is actually from Aberdeenshire Council. This area, I mean, there's been a lot of humour about this, because when they started building paths for this, there was talk of kids canoeing to school and things. It is a known floodplain.
Yes,
what else do you do with it?
Well, yeah, I mean, we know it's a floodplain and we have to work within that boundaries. We work with SEPA when we were designing it to make sure that we weren't changing the capacity of the floodplain, and that was something that we had to bear in mind. But yeah, there's very little else we can do because we can't raise the levels. It has to stay at grade, so everything we do here has got to keep the same capacity.
Whose idea was it to actually turn this into a recreational area? You know, a wetlands park, essentially.
I was involved with the individual who did do some initial thinking on it, a chap called Ron Reed, back in the late 90s. And it was a concept at the time that it would be available for the whole of the town, and it was part of the sort of contribution from the developers, because you couldn't put any development in here. And it seemed a great opportunity to try to create something that would be, in my view, unique inside a Scottish town, which is this wonderful area of biodiverse park, so that lots of people could come in and enjoy it, learn from it, get out into the wilds, health and well-being, and at the same time, local school children could use it. It has so many opportunities within it.
Local school children can use it when it's not being a floodplain, an active floodplain, we should say. Because, I mean, you know, the water will cross the main road there, and we're standing below the level of the main road at the moment.
Yeah, but it's also quite good draining soil, certainly from the farmer that tended this, and it does go down quite quickly. But, I mean, it is what it is. It's the forces of nature, and we have to work within that. But, yeah, I mean, it's when it's not flooded, it is a park, and we're working within those constraints.
It's quite a big area.
Yeah, 60 hectares. Yeah, it's huge. It gives us a lot of potential to make different things. So that's why we've got different tree planting areas. We're going to have some plug plants put in. There's some more trees going in over there. So we've got lots of different areas. This will be an amenity grassland area, which will be for, you know, recreational sports, sort of an informal sports area. We did look at sort of a more formal football pitch, but that would require some sort of pavilion, and clearly we can't do any building. So, yeah.
We've been snuck up on from behind.
Oh, I noticed that. Paul.
Hi.
Hiya, Paul. How are you doing?
Good. We're trying to get a park run for this area. Quite a lot of running groups around here. Big run groups, Joe Scotland Contour, Joe Scotland Meldrum, Gazelles, Inch Trail Runners. And it's not just about those runners, it's about introducing new people to running. With park run, wherever it is, people have to respect the other people who want to use that. So you usually get indications about staying to the left and such like things. This kind of width is quite good. Mm-hmm. So if someone's come with a pram and a dog, like here, then you need to be able to get out their way.
What I really admire about this is that it is barely established and it's already being seriously heavily used. I mean, you're getting walkers, you're getting runners, you're getting, well, there's a guy coming up here in a wheelchair, dog walkers, all sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderfully well used. I mean, I have to say, I mean, I take my dog out here and every time I've been out, that, you know, there has been loads of people using it, and it's just, I mean, it's such a good route to the shops, keeps them off the busy road, it's great for kids on bikes. I mean, it's just a wonderful facility.
Yeah. When you talk about biodiversity too, I mean, I live locally, so, you know, I shop in that big retail estate in there. Come the winter time, you know, the light is fading, you hear the geese coming down onto here, etc. But aside from geese, what else?
Well, there's wonderful things like wading birds, the odd bird of prey, otters on site.
Wait, you get otters here?
Yes, there'll be otters here.
At that bridge, I've seen one.
You've seen that? Kingfishers have been seen on site. So there's lots and lots of things that love to use the site. What we're trying to do is to ensure that sort of towards the Sutterford end is heavily used, available, kick a ball about, perhaps have a picnic, just enjoy it, walk around. And as you go towards the sort of Daviot end, it gets quieter and gentler, and you can sit or stand and just enjoy what's there, the wonders of what's there, and it allows wildlife to sort of enjoy that area, nest that in that place, have burrows in that place, and so on. And that's near the school as well, which allowed the school kids to come across and enjoy that and learn from that as well.
What's the timescale of this? I mean, how many years is it going to take before it actually sort of comes to what you might regard as fruition?
So we're very fortunate of being in a position to get most of the sort of core planting done within the next year to 18 months. And after that, it'll need time to settle in. And I think we're probably looking at 5, 10, maybe 15 years. All the trees have got to grow, so you can perhaps, in those cases, look 40 and 50 years hence. And when some of the trees were being planted...
Let's face it, Martin, we're not going to see it.
No, we aren't. But interestingly, some of the families that turned up, we had two-year-olds, and they were being photographed with a line of sight to something that would be fixed, so they can come back in 20 or 30
That's
years
nice
time
idea.
And go, I planted this tree. Yeah. Isn't that a wonderful thing to be able to do?
Martin Auld there, Paul Douglas and Susan Adams at Uri Riverside Park, and they were telling me afterwards, somewhere there exists a photograph, that, you know, that it is a floodplain and it does flood, and the river was high, and the footpath takes a wee bit of a dip before the footbridge across to the school, and this kid had got so far and thought, okay, it's wet, it's flooded. I'm not going to walk all the way back round the way I've just come in order to get to school.
We're going through the mountains.
Exactly. Put the satchel on his head, and there's a photograph of this kid literally up to his armpits in the water, just wading through, saying, I'm going to school now.
Crocodile Callum.
So I thought it was brilliant.
A couple of folk got in touch saying, can you spell Uri for them? Because there was a bit of confusion if they were trying to find it on an internet search.
U-R-Y. U-R-Y. So, what would that be? Uniform, Romeo, Yankee, something like that.
Yeah, well spent. Hey.
There was a lot of stuff on social media this last week about, well, quite a lot of it concerned a cliff face in a quarry in Norfolk, which had been netted off for some reason. The effect of that was San Martin's flying back 5,000 miles, couldn't actually get into the nest site.
Yeah, and it's coming down now after public pressure, but we asked the question, is it happening in Scotland? Well, it's not the same, but it's certainly happening at some places like supermarkets. I went to investigate one example with a concerned local resident, Les Wallace. I'm standing outside a Tesco in Falkirk. I'm not actually on their premises. I'm on the towpath of the canal, but we're about 30 feet away from the Tesco store. Les, you and I have both been down having a wee look at it, and there's a definite issue against birds.
Oh, definitely. The whole front of this store has been netted off, and it's quite fine netting, a total bird deterrent, and on some of the beams, they're actually old anti-perching spikes as well.
So it's obviously been a problem in the past, because they've got these sort of anti-pigeon-type spikes to prevent the roosting there. And this looks like an extra layer of prevention of birds having access to those eaves.
Yep, definitely. I mean, it would totally exclude any bird access at all. The mesh is too fine to allow any birds through at all.
So when did you first notice it? Because we're not experts, but it looks newish to me.
Yeah, it does look pretty new. I've been coming to the supermarket since it was built about 9 years ago now. And it's only the past couple of months that I happened to look up and I noticed it was fine mesh, but once you see it, you don't miss it. And so it's been there a little while, but probably not very long.
And this is the whole underside. If you imagine a supermarket with the big protective structure out the front, the whole of the underside has got this very fine mesh netting. As I said, we're on the canal. This is Prime's house martin country. We're heading north as we speak.
Yep, definitely. I mean, a lot of migrant birds will be coming back right now. And the problem, the issue they face is a lack of nesting and roosting sites, because we don't have a lot of old trees, etc., and especially along this canal. So if provision had been made here for having bird nest here, it would have been a really good place for it.
Now, you can imagine that this would be perfect house martin territory.
Yeah, definitely. They really like feeding over water, and there's plenty of insect life in the canal because it warms up quite quickly in the spring.
We've got a canal boat going past this. That's what that noise is. I've spoken to a lady in Dingwall who said her local Tesco have just put up netting to stop house martins. She's contacted the store with no reaction. She didn't want to come on the radio because of potential backlash, but there's also stories about netting going up in Ellen, north of Aberdeen. It happened down south as well, I think it was Norwich, and such was the consumer reaction that Tesco took the netting down. Is there a possibility for that north of the border?
I hope so. I think awareness is increasing. It seems to be a new development with the netting, and hopefully we're going to start stop nipping it in the bud, because obviously it's a bad practice. We don't really need to do it. We should be make provision for birds nesting at places like this rather than totally discouraging them.
Because this is an eco supermarket.
It was indeed. It was built about 9 years ago, and unfortunately these days eco really just means cutting your carbon emissions and not much else. This could have been built with inbuilt nesting sites for birds, even roosting sites for bats, and an increasing number of places that are doing that, and they're even putting nest cams in the bird boxes so you can actually be inside a visitor centre or something and see the birds at the nest.
And you get bricks for swifts as well.
Yeah, exactly, and also things for bats. So it's just strange. This was a big expensive supermarket 9 years ago and there was no provision made then for including that, which is a bit of a shame.
You tried to contact Tesco. What reaction have you had?
I've had none so far. I contacted through their Facebook page for this particular Tesco supermarket. I sent a message through Facebook and someone got back to me and said the message was being passed to the manager, but I've heard nothing since, and that was on the 28th of March.
What would you like to happen?
Personally, I'd like to see them look at this policy and see if they can change things and start making more provision for nesting sites for birds and other wildlife rather than just totally exclude it. At the moment, I mean, it's a fair-sized site. There really isn't anything they're doing to help the local wildlife.
On their defence, these nets are above the trolleys. Presumably, they don't want bird poo all over the trolleys, but there must be a more grown-up solution.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, I personally, I wouldn't be too bothered about that if I'd seen an equal level of attention from the very beginning to create wildlife habitat and to accommodate it within the structure of the building, which is what you can do. And Tesco's are a big company. I mean, this was not exactly a cheap place to build, and it wouldn't have costed very much at all to incorporate some wildlife-friendly features.
Because there's a real shortage of swallow and house martin habitat.
Well, definitely. They are absolutely desperate for sites to feed in.
Les Wallace in Falkirk there. Now, we did get in touch with Tesco, but despite numerous emails and repeated phone calls, we haven't yet had a response.
Yeah, well, a few people got in touch and said that their local supermarket in Inverness, that has the supermarket, has netting on it. And yeah, it's one that might run and run against people. There is a good argument, because obviously you don't want your trolleys covered in bird droppings, but there are solutions, like put the trolleys somewhere else.
Yes.
But yeah, we welcome your thoughts on it, wherever you are in the world. Out of doors at bbc.co.uk.
Wherever you are in the world, quite a lot of places in the world, they have regular outdoor markets. Not necessarily farmers markets, but outdoor markets. I mean, they've got some fantastic ones in Turkey. I've seen them in France. I've seen them in Italy.
Everybody seems to do it very well, apart from us. We lost the habit.
Oh, well, that's not true. We do it well nowadays.
Well, we do it
there
better.
Was a time when we didn't do it at all.
Yeah, that's
now, wasn't that terribly long ago? It was about 20 years ago. All of a sudden they were reintroduced. It was BSE at the time. There was a bit of a crisis in British agriculture, full stop, and people couldn't sell their meat, and there was a breakdown in communication between farmers and between the public. And they tried to think, well, how on earth do we actually resolve that? Jim Fairley came up with the idea of having a farmer's market because he'd seen it in Europe and he thought, why couldn't it work
that,
here in Scotland? But I said to him, how did it all start?
It was basically a comment that came from the agricultural minister at the time, who was a guy called Lord Sewell, who said, if farmers want to get out of their current crisis, they'll have to market their way out of it. Now, that's a story that I've told 1,000 times. But it was that incentive to think differently and look at what our alternatives were. And back then, 20 years ago, there was no alternative. You either sold through the live ring, through the auction ring, or you sold to a slaughterhouse, and then the slaughterhouses then exported it, or they sold to supermarkets. The other thing about that time was the relationship that the farming community had with the public was very, very poor. We had this bad rap at the time. BSE was being blamed on the farming community. Then you had things like foot and mouth, and they called it Frankenstein foods for GM crops and all this sort of stuff. So there was a real bad feeling in the community about what farmers were. You know, people seemed to forget that we were providing food for the country. So it was looking for an alternative way to market your way out of trouble. And went to France, saw them doing it over there, and thought, well, this is what we can do to at least take a step towards re-engaging with the public. And those of us that do farmers' markets will get a bit of extra money. It's funny because I was speaking to a friend this morning. He found a receipt for 20 yows that he'd sold back in 1999. And he sold 20 yows for £40, £2 a head. That's where the industry was at that time. Because of the BSE crisis, total collapse in red meat, confidence and all that sort of stuff. So the whole point of farmers' markets was about making a bit extra money, but it was as much about the PR and re-engaging with the public to get them to remember that farmers produce food and that we're all part of the same community.
You mentioned France. I'm guessing here, but I would imagine if you went to France, you could say there's been a farmer market there since medieval days. You know, there's been a continuous line of succession. We didn't have that. Why? How did we manage to lose that?
I genuinely don't know, Mark. Perth is a market town. You've got Flesher's Vennel, you've got Meal Vennel, you've got the old side streets where the traders used to come into town, they bring their stock, but that disappeared a long, long time ago. I don't know if it was the rise of supermarkets that made our food shopping habits change. What I remember as a kid is that in the housing estate where I was brought up, there was a butcher's, there was a baker's, there was a post office, there was a newsagent's, there was a chippy. Your food buying options were there in your housing estate or within your community. You had the vans that would come round doing the fish, and we just bought food in a different way, and we seemed to be far more connected to our food at that point. But I also remember supermarkets like the old Willie Lowe's when it was taken over by Tesco's. You had this growth of the big supermarkets, the big out-of-town supermarkets, bigger, brighter, better, stack them high, sell them low. All of that seems to me to have been the driver towards this belief that food is cheap, and food shouldn't be cheap. Food should cost what it costs us to produce it safely, securely, with the demands that the public put on us as producers to do it with the best welfare standards, to the highest Scotch beef, Scotch lamb standards. You can't get that cheaply. And where we are just now, particularly with the politics of where we are at the moment, that's about to collide.
How difficult was it to actually find a location in Perth, to get the necessary permissions to organise it, to get the word out to fellow farmers?
Getting the word out to fellow farmers was probably the hardest bit, to be perfectly honest. I spent a lot of my time going round their doors, phoning them up, talking to them, and getting them to think differently. Because bearing in mind, farmers since after the Second World War had absolutely no need to think about the end product. they were told, go and produce food, produce as much of it as you can. This country will never starve again. We will subsidise you, we'll support you. And that is where that whole system developed from. So getting the farmers to actually take part was probably the most difficult part for me. In terms of getting the location and all that sort of stuff, to be perfectly honest, Perthing and Ross Council were fantastic. As soon as I managed to get myself in the door, they put money into it, they put staff into it, they got the environmental health officers to work with us, because we didn't know what we were doing at that time. And everybody worked together and collaborated, and they also put a great PR system in place. So everybody in the country knew that this farmers market was about to start. And I remember the very first morning, I had a panic attack.
Quite understand.
Yeah, I'd been out speaking to all these farmers, and yeah, this is going to be fantastic. They do it in France, they do it across Europe. Got them persuaded. So there's a dozen of us, went into the city of Perth. That was a town at that time. Went into the town, set up all these stalls, absolutely confident it was going to work, until I got there. I'm standing in the street going, oh my God, what if nobody turns up? What if nobody actually supports this thing? And I'm just looking at all these other farmers there, they had their wild boar and ostrich and all the things that we had on that very first market, and thinking, good God, I might have sold them a pup and nobody could turn up here. And I got a real panic. But then just about 9 o'clock, one or two people started to come in. I saw one or two sales happening, and this woman came up to my stall and she looked into the box and she went, is that lamb's mince? I says, aye. She said, I'll have a packet of that. As though she had done it her entire life. And from then, it's a blur, because it just exploded. The place just filled with people, and by 12 o'clock, most of us were sold out. So from 9 till 12, we sold everything that we had. It was phenomenal.
There are a lot of folk out there who want quality, who want to be established provenance, all that kind of thing. There is still, I think, an awful lot of folk out there that will buy on the basis of price.
Yes, there is absolutely no doubt about it. We all want the better things in life. That we used to spend about 30% of our household income on food. Now, if you go back 50, 60 years, that's what you would have spent on your food. Now, we spend about 8%.
Several other farmers' markets were set up in the wake of Perth.
Yeah.
They're still being set up.
Yes, I remember at its height, when we set up the Scottish Association of Farmers' Markets, at its height, we had about 65 farmers' markets throughout the country. Some of them weren't actually farmers' markets. They were kind of markets that were held in town centres. But that's fine as well. As long as people have the opportunity to go and buy that local product, then that's fine. A lot of them have fallen by the wayside. The economics of them became very difficult for people. The price of processing and all the rest of it increased dramatically over the years. And a lot of farmers' markets just fell out of favour. If I'm being honest, there was a period of time where we thought farmers' markets were done. You know, they'd served their purpose. And in reality, if you think about what the initial aims were, it was to re-engage with the public. It was to get our branded products greater recognition. It was to get people to actually feel supportive of those branded products. We got far more engagement with the Scottish Government in particular. They set up the National Food and Drink Policy for Scotland. That has produced Scotland Food and Drink, the organisation Scotland Food and Drink. There is far more engagement now with public procurement, so that they're looking at trying to buy as much product locally as they possibly can, looking at value for money rather than best price. So there's a whole host of things that have come out of that period of time. There's been this real transformation in the food and drink industry. Ambition 2030, it's the next stage of that Scotland Food and Drink, is to make the industry worth £30 billion by the year 2030 and to employ up to 1 million people. Now, that's a phenomenal ambition. But one of the things that's going to have to happen is absolute collaboration. And we need to protect our brands, our local brands, our regional brands, and our national brands. So Scotch needs to be protected. Stornoway Black Pudding needs to be protected. And the best way to do that is to be a good food nation. James Withers, the chief executive of Scotland Food and Drink, said, if we're going to be a good food nation, we actually have to live it and we have to be a good food nation. So being available to people, being at farmers' markets, is an essential part of that whole mix of stuff that's going on. We are 1 million miles away from where we were 20 years ago. You know, we were talking then about deep-fried Mars bars, you know, the sick man of Europe. Our food and drink industry was there, but it wasn't. Now, the world over, looks at our food and drink industry and thinks, hey, that's something to buy into. The UK government have tried to emulate what Scotland Food and Drink did by doing their Great Britain campaign for food. But we're already years ahead of that game. So that needs to be standing in its own right and continuing to drive towards Ambition 2030, which will be good for the environment, it will be good for the consumers, it will be good for the agricultural community. If we all buy into it and collaborate with it, then that is fantastically exciting.
Jim Fairley there, founder of the first farmers market in Scotland, and the next market in Perth will be on Saturday the 4th of May. But do have a look around, because they're all over Scotland nowadays.
Yeah, but they're all, the rest of the world will be listening with incredulity, but it's such a relatively new thing here. I was in Croatia the back end of last year, and they've got a lovely bit in the square where the council have put up stone stalls. They provide all the stone, the infrastructure for people to come along. Some folks are selling five tomatoes, whatever, but it was a great feeling. Go along and get lumpy vegetables and really tasty tomatoes. I just love the whole feeling of being able to wander through a market and pick and choose.
We've been going to the south of Turkey every year for the last 4 or 5 years now, and the markets there, it's the colours. The sheer range of colours, because obviously it is so, even when we go, you've got to cover the produce, you know, it'd be too hot otherwise. But, you know, the tomatoes, the cucumbers, the oranges, everything, it's just a real assault on the senses. It's wonderful.
Yep.
Anyway, the Ardea Peninsula in North Ayrshire is the largest area of acid grassland in the UK. As we were saying earlier in the podcast, it was once the site of a truly huge explosives factory, but it's now an important home for pollinators and birds, and it's under threat.
Yeah, this is a strange one. What had happened is a 65-year-old government order dating from when the factory was first built, and it's allowing developers to excavate and flatten the dunes without having to apply for full planning permission. Standing up and challenging them is wildlife expert Ian Hamlin.
We're stood on top of a sand dune on the Ardeer Peninsula, and we're looking out over the Firth of Clyde in one direction, and in another direction we're looking over the Ardeer Peninsula.
It is a fantastic sight. We're going to go down here, because as you can hear, it is seriously blown a hoolie off the ocean there. God, that's better. I've never been here before. It's a dramatic location.
It is. I mean, it's a sweeping landscape of sand dunes and old factory buildings and woodland.
So what was it?
Well, in 1872, it was set up as a dynamite factory by Alfred Nobel, and it expanded and diversified.
This is Nobel as in Peace Prize Nobel.
That's right, founder of the Nobel Peace Prize. The factory grew to form part of ICI, and it was a gigantic chemical plant in the 20th century, employing well over 10,000 people at its peak.
And we've got a lot of strange, I thought they were sand dunes when we came down here, but kind of curved shapes, but not sand dunes.
That's right. For the purposes of explosives manufacturing, the dunes have been shaped in places into blast walls. So we've got all kinds of strange earthworks and structures for the purposes of controlling the blasts caused by dynamite.
It's a weird environment. There's rotting buildings. You've got these blast walls, as you say. Bits of sand dune all over the place. It's quite a fascinating wee part of the world.
It is. It's been used recently, actually, as a filming location for a zombie movie, because it looks pretty apocalyptic in places.
But it is special, because a couple of years ago, you suddenly got access to this.
That's right. Back in 2009, the fence came down effectively. For generations, it had been fenced off from the public and, by extension, from naturalists. But 10 years ago, we were allowed to wander freely, and since then we've discovered a huge amount of biodiversity in the dunes.
But that must have been great from a naturalist point of view, of getting access to somewhere that had been untouched by man for decades.
That's right, it felt like a journey of discovery, really, to wander about the dunes and for the first time discover what was actually here.
So what did you find?
Well, among other things, we found over 100 species of bee and wasp, and that's the largest site list of anywhere in Scotland. We've also found 33 species of nationally scarce invertebrates. That includes rare sand dune spiders, flies, beetles and moths.
So this is a special place from the point of view of biodiversity.
It is a very special place. The council undertook a review of their nature conservation sites over the past few years, and the peninsula emerged as the most biodiverse site in the county.
So we have an amazing wildlife resource, incredible insect resource from the point of view of pollination. The council's saying it's an important site as well, but it's under threat.
It is. Everyday sand extraction happens on an industrial scale in the dunes. Sand dunes are effectively bulldozed onto the backs of lorries and carted away and sold commercially as sand.
How can that be if it's so important from a biodiversity point of view that folk can come in a truck and a bulldozer and take the sand away?
Well, unfortunately, a special development order was passed in 1953 that allows pretty much any development to go ahead in the dunes without having a planning application submitted. So, effectively, blanket planning permission covers the dune system, and that includes sand extraction. Operators can set up sand extraction sites without actually submitting planning applications.
Yeah, but that was decades ago. Did that right to avoid planning permission go with the new owner when the site was sold?
Unfortunately, yes, it's never been revoked. It still exists, even though the chemical plant that the order was created for has long since gone.
That can't be right, surely.
It's a travesty. It's pretty awful, and we're very keen for sand extraction to stop and for the order to be revoked.
But it's not just sand extraction you're worried about.
That's right. There are other threats to the dunes as well. There are plans for large-scale housing developments in the dunes and for a marina as well.
Well, right here?
Right here in the dunes. Housing throughout most of the southern part of the dunes has been proposed.
That's really hard to believe when you consider the importance of this site. You know, it should be a triple SI, it should be a nature reserve.
It should be. It would have been a triple SI if it hadn't been a factory. If it hadn't been fenced off from the world and such an economic asset, it would have long ago been declared a triple SI.
There must be serious time pressure on this. At one end, they're digging up all the sand dunes. At the other end, they want to build houses in the marina. It's sad to say, it doesn't look great for this site.
No, there are threats coming from all directions, and every day the dunes are being destroyed. Every day, more and more dunes get chucked onto the backs of lorries and sold for sand.
What needs to happen here?
Well, several things need to happen. The first thing is that the development order needs to be revoked so that activities on the peninsula can be regulated. The site should also be declared a triple SI on account of its habitat value and invertebrate assemblage. And the plans to develop housing in the dunes ought to be scrutinised. They've bypassed the wildlife NGOs, and there needs to be a serious chat about whether or not this development is suitable for a sand dune system.
So things like the various wildlife trusts, RSPB, nobody gets a say?
Well, the Ayrshire Growth Deal plans have pretty much evolved without consultation. So the RSPB, SWT, even SNH have not really had much of an input into these plans.
Naturalist Ian Hamlin at the Ardeer Peninsula in Ayrshire. And we'll have more from that later in the podcast.
I've been speaking to somebody from the Scottish Wildlife Trust who are up in arms with the fact that they can't even be consulted at the development. But stick with us, that's later on.
A couple of weeks ago, Ewan and I were down at a place called Glenfinglas. And we were down there to chat primarily to a naturalist and a wildlife author called Jim Crumley about his new book, The Nature of Spring.
Yeah, and that'll be in a podcast coming up soon as well.
Indeed. But while we were there, I met up with Gwen Rees, who's a state manager with the Woodland Trust. They've got an absolutely massive forest down there. It's beautiful. They're doing wonderful things with it. And she told me more about the glen.
Ooh.
That's a bit of a climb.
Takes your breath away, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a fantastic view.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah, we're at Glenfinglas, sitting halfway up the hill of Landrick Hill, kind of overlooking Lochfanagher and the lower grounds. And we're surrounded by lovely broadleaf trees and bird songs.
This is part, let me get this right, the Great Trossachs Woodland National Nature Reserve.
Nope.
Oh, well, if I don't hit it, I stagger it.
It's pretty close. It's the Great Trossachs Forest National Nature Reserve.
Oh, it's close.
Yeah, it's Come very on, close.
Tell you, we've just slogged our way up quite a steep path there, and my glasses have steamed up. I'm going to have to take them off. I can't see what I'm doing. This woodland, or forest, has got many, many more trees nowadays than there used to be.
Yeah, in the old days it was part of an upland hill farm, so it would have been grazed by sheep mainly. And then when the trust acquired it in 96, we started planting trees. In the meantime, natural regen has occurred as well, and there's a little bit of woodland that had conifers on it, but that was previously an ancient woodland. Mm-hmm. So we've gradually removed those conifers and kind of allowed the native species to kind of grow back on it and restore it.
How long were the conifers there?
Oof, they must have been there. I can't give you exact figures with regards of it, but it must have been several years because it was valuable timber that they took out of it as well.
So you're probably talking at least 30 years, and yet when you take the trees away, the seed stock is still below them and it'll come up again.
Yeah, yeah, I would have.
Yeah, it's just extraordinary.
Yeah, it's brilliant. They just transformed the whole landscape. It's been beautiful.
I mean, people talk about planting. We've planted lots and lots of trees. I read somewhere you've got, what, about 1.5 million more nowadays than you had?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's that's pretty excessive.
That's pretty excessive, yeah. And that's only, like, kind of on the lower slopes as well. We've got more in the up in the glens as well, where trees would have been planted, where natural regen we're trying to encourage as well. So it's been big scale.
And this is part of a plan that's going to take you up for another 30 years to 2050.
Yeah, and the kind of, and that's the nice thing with the Great Rossex Forest as well, is that it links up with other landowners, so it just becomes, almost the size of Glasgow that we're talking about, that we're looking at actually bringing in that woodland, but not just woodland, it's like a mosaic of different habitats.
What kind of trees are we talking about? You said native trees, but what?
So we're talking about birch species, oaks, rowan, willows. Higher up the slopes, we'll go to like juniper species as well, and kind of into the montane. There's some aspen in and amongst it. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice range of different species.
So what, in terms of wildlife, birds, animals, etc., what colonises that?
It goes from your small woodland birds to your mammals like your red squirrel and bigger woodland birds like the woodpeckers. And then you've got your lovely birds of prey, your ospreys, your golden eagles, your buzzards.
I was just sitting down in the car park and you could hear, it took me a while to spot it because it was across the other side of the road, but you know, there was two buzzards mewing. Whether they're coming into a breeding season or not, I don't know, but they were just circling each other. And then as I'm looking at them through the trees, I became aware of the fact in the foreground, almost looking like a mouse running up the side of the tree, was this tree creeper.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a lovely wee bird.
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah, it sticks to the bark of the trees, isn't it? It just kind of goes up. It's great. You blink away and it's just gone. And then it comes, peaks across again as well. It's really nice.
This is actually quite a reflective place to come. It's not, you know, we're not talking hundreds of people. I've seen a few people here, but I mean, there are lots and lots of paths, lots and lots of space, and lots of peace and quiet.
Yeah. That's the feedback people give often as well, is although it's within the national park, it's a really quiet place. You could come here at any time of the day and there will be somewhere where you won't see anybody and you could just kind of absorb nature sounds and smells. And I think that's the uniqueness of the place as well. And I think it's because it's so big, it kind of gives people that do come space to venture out to different corners and kind of find the little niches that they're interested in and that they like to explore.
What we're sitting surrounded by at the moment, and there's nothing in leaf, is predominantly silver birch. There's downy birch across there.
Yeah.
But everything's that sort of slightly damson-y colour, you know, because you're looking at the twigs more than anything else. And to my uneducated eye, we're looking at trees that may be 20, 25 years old. But you wander through here, there are some really old, really venerable trees, trees with character.
Yeah. If we would have just continued walking up the trail, we would actually have come across some of the really nice old alders and hazels that either would have been coppiced in the past or would have been pollarded.
Would you call those again, lollipop trees or something?
Yes.
Yeah. The lollipop. They end up that shape.
Yeah, with a nice round canopy bit and then a single stem on it. So that livestock in the past would have been able to kind of graze underneath it without damaging the actual tree. And they are such a pleasure to look at. It's beautiful.
And today is a slightly damp sort of day. I mean, the clouds coming down just on the top of the hills there, it's got that slightly soft feeling about it. It's, to my mind, a moist landscape at the moment. Fire risk would be reasonably low, but fire can be a problem here.
Yes, especially we're approaching the season for hellfire risks, kind of early spring when, like you say, everything is still kind of in the kind of winter stage with a lot of like dead vegetation that kind of gives a brown colour and kind of that dead heather as well, which is catching fire really, really quickly on a dry, windy day.
But you had a really bad one not that many years ago, didn't you?
Yeah, it was early 2000s that we had a bad hellfire. It actually kind of wiped everything away that we saw. So what you see is about 15 years old coming up now.
And what's the plans for the future? What do you hope this will achieve long term?
So we kind of want to want to allow woodland to come back and give it time is something that doesn't happen overnight. And I think as humans, we like to kind of rush these things. But equally, we also want to have that mosaic where you've got the grasslands and the heathlands kind of coming through and linking that up so that it actually benefits the wildlife that lives in it. So that's kind of our long-term aspiration for the estate.
Personalise something. Just when we were walking up the path, you said that you get bored very quickly. You get bored very easily. We were joking about a butterfly mind. That's an unusual mindset for somebody that's involved with trees, because trees are really long term.
That's very true, but I've got a lot of stuff to keep me busy while these trees are growing, so I think it should be fine.
Gwen Roy is there, estate manager with the Woodland Trust at Glenfinglas, and in case you're wondering about her accent, she's Belgian.
It is a fantastic accent. Yeah. A lot of reaction to it, so people could listen to that all day.
That's it. Bring her back, they said, bring her back.
Yeah. Now, we love hearing about where you listen. You can email your stories out of doors at bbc.co.uk, which is what Philip Cottrell did.
He says, I'm in Canada with 4 hours of commuting time each day. 4 hours.
4 hours?
Aye. I love to listen to the podcast and get a taste of Scotland. I've been to the Highlands several times in the last 15 years, most notably having a fall on Ben Hope and being lucky to escape with my life. Oh, my goodness. A few broken bones is all I suffered. Well, I'm glad to hear it. It says, last year I spent time in Orkney and I'm taking my wife and another couple back there. I think that means my wife and another couple, as opposed to another couple of wives, back there in about 3 weeks. We can't wait to make the ferry journey to Stromness again with Hoy rising in the foreground. This time we're going as far as Papi.
You'll love it. Especially if you get the wee flight across through to Papa Westry.
Uh-huh.
Just brilliant. Perhaps you'll get to sit beside the pilot.
But only if I'm not there.
Yeah, Captain Biggles gets there first.
Yeah, too straight.
A wee bit earlier, I was chatting to Ian Hamilton, who's trying to save the wildlife potential of the Ardeer Peninsula. Now, Jill Smart from the Scottish Wildlife Trust believes that the habitat should be managed and preserved, and are planning a proposal how to save and preserve the dunes. All, as she told me, inspired by Ian.
Well, I think he's fantastic. He's been a real catalyst to all of us getting interested in the Ardeer Peninsula and its wildlife.
But it's amateur science. It's a lot of amateur people piling in there.
So, yes, lots of local people come along, and people from Glasgow, Paisley as well, come down and do birds and all sorts of things on the peninsula.
So how many species are you finding?
Well, our tally up till now is over 1,000, and we've just scratched the surface, I think.
That's plants, insects?
That's plants, mammals, insects, spiders, that kind of thing.
You say, is that just scratching the surface? Because presumably, it is citizen science at the moment. There's a big place, a lot of work to be done.
Yes, there's a fair bit of work to be done. We've done fairly intensive beetle surveys.
What about the actual structure or the way that this factory was built? Because it's such a massive area.
Well, because it was an explosives factory and all the buildings were separate from each other for safety reasons, wildlife was carrying on in between in the sand dune system. And when the factory demolished, the wildlife was able to quickly move into to those demolished areas.
And it had quite a few decades with a fence round it. It was kind of almost a double-edged sword, because it's given the protection that perhaps it hasn't got now.
Yes, it certainly kept everybody out. It made it all the more exciting to come in and explore this new land.
What was that like when the fence went down? Because that must be almost unique in Scotland, and unique in many countries. Here's an area that nobody's been in for 5 decades.
Yes, I don't really remember if there was a day when the fence went down. I think it just gradually got holes in it and people poked their way through and came in.
Well, I had an image of you all there with your crowbars and piling in with your binoculars. Yeah.
So, as they were interested, came and started to explore.
What was that like, the fact, you're all excited, you've got a whole new wildlife area to play with, and then suddenly you realise there's some of the threats that Ian was touching on earlier on, the sand extraction?
It really is quite upsetting, actually, to be honest, and because we've come to love the place, and we know that the local people also love it from the point of view just taking walks and getting out into the fresh air, and to think that it might become a no-go area or might be built upon is not nice.
It must almost be more horrible, because suddenly you've got a great resource and then left hand takes it away.
There's so much more to find, and we're enjoying ourselves so much looking for the wildlife and telling people about it and getting people interested in the place, and then to find that we may not have much longer to do that.
There's also the fact, as I touched on with Ian, this strange order, which means there's no planning regulation, no planning scrutiny required. That must be almost unique.
Yes, it's a strange situation. We don't have any of the normal planning rules apply, where you can get consulted over anything that's going to happen for unable to do anything.
That's bizarre, because you've got a great wildlife resource. You guys are the experts. The RSPB are the experts. Scottish Natural Heritage are the experts. You know, wildlife trusts. They have a huge amount of information to impart, and you're not even getting to the table.
I know. I mean, if you were building a conservatory on the side of your house and it happened to be next to a nature area, you'd be consulted. But we're not consulted over this fabulous place where some sort of ginormous development might take place. And it's just very unfair not to be able to have our say.
But you would have thought local people would want to say as well, because I've been out here. There's folk walking their dogs everywhere. They're loving it. They're enjoying it. I can't see how you can take the wildlife out of any development decision.
Oh, that's right. I mean, the local people enjoy it, and they want to see something happening there that will benefit them and maybe help them economically, but also socially and for their mental health. Walking out on the dunes is going to be a lovely experience.
Let's nail this in the head. You're not against development per se, though. This isn't people versus wildlife.
No, it's not. Nothing like that at all. We just need to see the right development in the right place and have it done sustainably, so that what's there is good, gets preserved and looked after, and then we can possibly put the harder developments on places that are less sensitive.
There's plans for houses and there's suggestions for economic development. Where do you stand on both of them?
Well, not so keen on the housing, I think.
There's a lot of houses around.
Yeah, well, there's plenty of already designated areas in the local plan for housing. And if you built houses on the peninsula, it would be sort of giant clusters of houses, whereas before the factory was just sort of dispersed buildings. So it would completely change the layout of the wildlife connectivity.
There's also the potential to become a rich man's playground. Well, this could be a great site for very expensive houses.
I don't think the people of Stevenson would be very keen on that either.
So what would you like to see happen? You want more economic stimulus? You want more factories?
We want something that will certainly help regenerate the area and give people jobs and activities. And that can come from a whole range of things. From wildlife tourism could be one of it. There could be small-scale cafes or...
Is there a time constraint here? Because I've seen the diggers. You can have all the consultation you want. If the sand dunes are gone, it's pointless.
Yes, it's getting quite urgent, especially with this unregulated development that's going on. We really need to start having input into what's going on.
Do you need to be shouting louder?
Well, we're trying. We're shouting as loud as we can, and we will continue to find different ways of bringing it to public attention so that we get more help.
Jill Smart, Scottish Wildlife Trust Reserve Manager for South West Scotland there.
It's just a loophole. Somebody's missed a loophole.
Indeed. Right, let me take you back a bit. Where we are standing is the BBC Aberdeen car park. But once upon a time, there was a really handsome building standing here. And behind the building, there was a garden. Mm. You know, and it wasn't just decorative. They actually did a television programme from there, which was called, curiously enough, The Beech Grove Garden.
It was a great place. You go at lunchtime, there'd be filming, but there's plants and vegetables. It was, you know, things change and the reasons for it, but it was a lovely place to visit.
They moved the garden and the filming from here to the outskirts of Aberdeen. And earlier this week, I went for a nosy because the television series is still going strong, and like they were just beginning to start work on this year's series. This is Bonnie. The sun shining through these blue-green needles on a conifer onto this man-made waterfall. There's a pool behind me. Surprising amount of flowers out here at the moment, stands of bamboo. It's just a peaceful place to be, which is surprising because they're just about to shoot the opening shot of this year's series in one of the longest-running shows on British television. This is Brotherfield, where they filmed the Beech Grove Garden nowadays. Gwyneth Hardy is the boss lady.
The Beech Grove Garden was basically specially designed to be an outdoor studio, if you like, a green studio, proper big green room, all the bits and pieces, all the pieces of the fence panels come out so that we can get different views into places. The gardeners get very upset when we start to take pieces out of the greenhouses or carve holes in the polytunnels. But in order to get different views and to let our viewers see as much as possible from all sorts of different angles and from the plant's eye view, then that's what we do. We have really wide paths so we can run pieces of kit through it and so on. And we have electricity and, you know, at all different parts of the garden. So it is actually built as a set, as a green set.
Now, carrying that trug, or that trug's already in here? Which do you prefer? What's going to look nicest?
Do them coming on.
The production team, the cameramen, the sound guys move about the garden all the time, and they're now down at the polytunnels. And they've got a camera and a jib, so they can move it about and raise it up and down and things. They've got the presenters the other side of the polytunnel, and they've basically taken the back wall of the polytunnel out, just as Gwyneth was describing.
OK, everybody set? Turnover, please. OK, Carol and Jim, when you're ready.
People say, how big is this garden compared with the other? Well, the other one was obviously just the back garden in town. This here I describe as being about the size of two football pitches. It gives people a sort of idea. So scope. It gave us scope to do all sorts of things. It had been a tree nursery. So it was levelled and it was terraced and these walls were put in and stuff. And basically the original comment was, how did you get the Beech Grove started and how did you set your standards? We said, well, let's do a semi-detached suburban garden. What can you get in it? Expanded very slightly. I mean, it was about the size of a double tennis court maybe in town. So we started at either end and we did small gardens, examples of a little woodland garden, a little terrace garden, a little no-maintenance garden. We're sitting looking here at some little pillar trees, you know, like the poplars. For people with a very small garden, but fancy having a tree of some kind, there's an example. So we can develop, and then we can actually start to do little bits of testing this, new varieties and so on. And because my big thing is in the veg plot to go no-dig.
It's my vote.
I wish I'd thought about it 50 years ago.
Wouldn't be in this state now.
I've been involved in the Beech Grove Garden since 1983, so I started as a gardener behind the scenes.
As a child, really?
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yes, I was only five when I started. and then as a presenter, 1986. And here we are. What is it? It is now
35, 36 years old.
It is. Yeah. And I love this time of year because everything is fresh, everything is growing. And just look at the beautiful daffodils at the moment. Yeah. I actually think at this time of year, I feel quite calm because especially since we've had a good winter, my garden at the moment, even at home, looks quite tidy. But then in a few weeks' time, you know, that's when the weeds start to grow and everything else. But I think this is a beautiful time of year, definitely.
Hear a plane droning overhead and the bee droning through this lungwort, the pulmonaria. There's azalea just about to come out. And lichen growing on the silver birch. Catkins on this willow. The garden is surprisingly full of life at the moment. And as peaceful as this bit is, across there, the production team are still hard at it.
Right, Brian. Everything's precision here, you know. 60 first, and then 75. And then stick your stick in. I'm George Anderson, one of the presenters on Beech Grove, and Brian Cunningham and I are going to be tasked with the planting of potatoes today. Usually this is Jim's job, so big responsibility.
How's Jim managed to skive over this guy?
I don't know, he's away doing something else at the moment. Yeah. Because it's always busy here, whenever we're recording, Mark, it's one of these days that you just have to get on with it.
How many programmes on television actually concentrate exclusively on two things, passion and beauty? You know, everybody's passionate about it, and when you get it, well, not you, you fool. You're not beautiful.
Yeah, you're going a bit far there. Yeah. Yeah, but you're right. You're right. It's about design. It's about the infinite beauty of an individual bloom. I mean, I show daffodils, and what a crazy world that is. But you're looking for perfection in a daffodil.
I just enjoy gardening in general, and that's one of the things I enjoy about Scone, just presenting nice lawns, nice beds with shrubs and perennials, and as you say, bulbs coming through, and then all these added extras when you realise that tree you're growing from has got such an amazing history. You know, seed sent back by David Douglas 200 years ago, and there's that very tree that you're looking after. It's brilliant.
What a heritage we have to look after, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, both sure. Running speed?
Sure.
Okay, Jim, when you're ready to Martin.
And according to RHS figures, more than half the population of the UK are gardeners. So welcome to all of you. And you know, before we go any further, have you noticed the youngins are arriving?
I have, yes.
Yes. Brian we know all about, we've seen him before, but welcome to Kirsty Wilson.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're delighted to see you. And what about the setup here and the weather?
Kirsty Wilson is the latest addition to the lineup of presenters on the Beech Grove Garden. Your day job is down at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh. What's the linkage between that? Because that's kind of high-powered, and this?
Well, it's sort of similar, but bringing plants to people, educating them about conservation and also, you know, connecting people with nature. I feel at the moment a lot of people are disconnected from nature, and bringing them back and inspiring particularly young people into gardening and horticulture. And you see now there are so many health benefits to being surrounded by nature and plants, and I think the world is really wakening up to that now. And my work at the Royal Botanic Garden Edinburgh really highlights conservation and how we need to protect this planet and look after the plants. After all, plants are life.
Making gardening programmes is a joy from end to end, because it's always about people's passions and it's always about beautiful things, and it's not about getting under the skin or finding out or, you know, making a documentary that's going to upset people or whatever. This is about celebration of gardening and of life, and what could be nicer.
Producer Gwyneth Hardy there. We also heard from Gentleman Jim McCall, Carol Baxter, George Anderson, Brian Cunningham, and the bees of the Beech Grove Garden.
Have you let it out the jar yet?
No. Of course, when you need a sound effect, of course I have. Of course there's nowhere near a jar.
Don't bother writing.
Yeah. Now, over the years, we have encouraged you, because we've done it ourselves, actually. We create soundscapes. You know, we go out and record stuff that's just random, and said to you, right, if you hear something interesting, please do the same.
We must confess, we've been holding them for a wee while to put a wee montage together. And this is the international soundscape that you guys out there have sent in. Some of them quite exotic. See if you can guess what they are.
Some lovely, interesting stuff in amongst that.
Yeah, it was Kentucky, I think.
Well, let's start with the last one. Okay. Because that was the last one we heard. It says, this is from Brian. It says, I live in Vancouver, British Columbia. Recent night, about 9 p.m, I stepped out the front door of our local tennis club and thought I could hear some frogs. He basically followed the sound, but 400 metres from the front door of his club. He says, it was a truly loud chorus. I took out my phone and made a short soundscape. I hope you enjoy it.
It's great. I loved it.
Yeah, perfect.
So we started with that. A very distinctive noise, and that was Georgetown, Kentucky.
Indeed. This is from Al Mann, an expat Breakener, saying, standing beside the pond in our backyard, the traffic on the main road about half a mile away slowly fades, and the tree frogs are in fine voice. Perhaps you could come and do a programme on the Kentucky Wildcat.
Oh, yes.
Just... we'll be there very quickly.
My USA visa is still valid.
I think so maybe too.
Should be.
Yeah, exactly. We apologised. The second track that you actually heard there, and this was really quite strange.
Scary sounder.
Yeah, it's from Colombia, the Tayrona National Park, and it was howler monkeys. And that was from Pamela and Tom Brewis from Berwick-upon-Tweed. And the number three one I wasn't terribly certain about.
Palizada River in Mexico, and that was from Gavin Shand.
Okay.
Lovely sounding. You can do that. Just get your smartphone, record it, and email to outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Now, Nigel and Angela in West Sussex emailed in, said, to everyone involved in the production of the excellent Out of Doors programme, we've been listening down here on the south coast of England via your podcast for years now, and the programme continues to deliver a great listening and learning experience. Helen Needham's feature on Fire and Peace Wild Camp near Avi Moore was an outstanding piece of broadcasting. Please keep up the excellent work.
Funny enough, I listened back to that too, this last week on the BBC Sounds app, and it was excellent. It was a really good piece of recording. Anyway, that's all for this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. Don't forget, you can always contact us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. From all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for downloading us.